Our next case is United States v. Matty. Major Herbers, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? Major Barris, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Major Nicole Herbers, representing John P. Matty. I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The prosecutor exploited the evidence to secure a win when he wove 4 separate categories of improper argument throughout findings and rebuttal. First, he shifted the burden. Second, he bolstered his case by disparaging defense. Third, he vouched for. And fourth, he inserted facts not in evidence. These errors were plain and obvious. The government cannot show that the burden-shifting argument was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Looking at these 4 separate categories of improper argument, it is important to note that this court has given us a plethora of cases to establish that they are plain and obvious error. We have Voorhees, we have Fletcher, we have Norwood, we have Mason and Carter for the burden-shifting arguments, yet here we are again. Let's start.
Major, you've just given us a litany of the cases, and it is true, there have been a bunch of these, but why don't defense counsel argue what you're arguing at the trial, or at least object?
Your Honor, they should have objected. These errors were plain and obvious. There should have been an objection. And the
right, but there's no ineffectiveness of assistance claim, because then you'd have to show that, you'd also have to show there was a harmlessness analysis at that point as well. So why, I mean, at least that would help you, don't you think?
Your Honor, in order to answer the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we still have to look at the prosecutor's independent duty not to make these type of arguments. So we would still be having the same discussion.
Well, right, but I guess I'm talking about on the issue of harmlessness. I mean, if it is so harmful, I still don't get why defense lawyers are not objecting.
They did have an obligation to object, and they failed to do so. The judge failed as well, but the prosecutor also overstepped the bounds by making this argument. And the defense failure and the military judge failure to stop this type of argument does not excuse the prosecutor here.
If counsel are presumed to be competent, are they not? Aren't we to presume that the defense lawyer at the trial is just as competent as you are?
Yes.
You might be more competent. I'm not sure. But the defense counsel at the trial is at least as competent as you are. Isn't that true?
There is the presumption, but when we're focusing on the issue before us, when we're evaluating whether these errors were plain and obvious, what's controlling is the arguments that were made by the prosecutor.
Right, but the trial defense counsel is in a better position than you are.
Yes, Your Honor.
He or she is sitting there listening to this lawyer drone on in real time, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is one factor that this court can consider when we're looking at prejudice under the prong of the curative measures that were taken. Mm-hmm. But when we're evaluating here these arguments, that is only one factor. There are multiple other things that this court could consider to determine whether this caused the harm that we're alleging. And that is both the severity of the conduct, the measures to cure, and also the weight of the evidence. And in this case,
well, you're not suggesting that trial defense counsel is letting this misconduct come in just so that they will have an appellate issue.
Are
you
no,
not
Your Honor.
Suggesting that, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Because that would be unethical, I think, wouldn't it?
That would be problematic, yes, Your Honor. We're not suggesting that there was any sort of deliberate choice not to object. We're saying it was error not to. But the focus of this argument and what we would have to decide, regardless if there was ineffective, is whether the prosecutor stepped over the line. And we do have evidence that the prosecutor stepped over the line, not only with the burden-shifting argument, where there is the standard of harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, but also because in context of those burden-shifting arguments, we also have the prosecutor disparaging the defense and saying, they're selling you lies and conspiracy theories. This is a conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy theory. They have to prove to you that all of these people are lying. That, along with the burden-shifting argument of what other explanation has the defense given you? I note several point in the joint appendix for this court, page 232, 234, 235, and 250 and 51. The language that is used in these arguments is, who else were you presented with? What wasn't provided to you? wasn't provided. It's a lie, it's a lie, it's all lies. The defense needs to get up here and say that all of these people are lying to you. The defense doesn't have to do anything, first. Second, to acquit, they do not have to believe that every witness is a liar. And that is what the prosecutor did with their argument. They took the evidence as it was, and they changed the landscape through these four different ways. First,
but counsel, this is going back to Judge Sparks' question. As you said, they took the evidence as it was. He was acquitted on two, and this is the prejudice issue. He was acquitted on two. He was convicted on two. We have the military judge providing the normal instructions. Defense counsel did not request any specific instructions. So again, when we're trying to even if we get to the harmless beyond reasonable doubt, assuming arguendo is constitutional error and harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, how do you argue that it was that the government failed to show that when the government that the panel was prejudiced by the potential misconduct when they in fact acquitted on two and no special instructions were requested nor provided?
Yes, Your Honor. The government agrees that the facts of this case are that specifications 1 and 4 only dealt with as the testimony to support those, and he was acquitted when she was the only one that the members relied on. Specifications 2 and 3 have this additional corroborative evidence of the bruising with the photographs and the witnesses, and the arguments were honing in on that additional evidence. So these improper arguments were directed at the additional evidence that only applied to specifications 2 and 3 of which he was convicted. So the evidence prior to these arguments were that his testimony was inconsistent with her own prior statements, that his testimony about the bruising was inconsistent with the evidence that she provided, which is the photographs. Her testimony was inconsistent with the time that she said this alleged assault occurred in May. Her testimony was inconsistent of when she took the photographs. And that was her own evidence that she provided. That was what they had at the outset. They also had testimony from, as it relates to the January conduct for specification 3. And that testimony was that she saw bruises at some point on her arms. She testified that it was a bite mark bruise, that it was on a specific forearm, and we don't have any of that corroboration coming from. And then in specification 2, in May of 2021, we have evidence that at some point she saw something on her chin, like a bruise or an injury on her chin. But she was never shown the photograph to corroborate that what said was the injury that occurred in May is actually what she saw. That's what they had at the outset. And after this argument is made, what they have is, what did the defense fail to give you? You need to believe because she's a victim of crime. She went through a hard investigative process, had to lay bare her entire life. All of the text messages that she's ever sent were poured into by these investigators. Believe her. She's telling you the truth.
Let me ask you this, Tom. I'm not beating up on you. I mean, we granted the case, so maybe it's on us. I don't know.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what if during your preparation for this particular appeal, you would have called the defense counsel down to the trial and said, hey, what's up with not objecting to all this stuff that's going on at the trial here? When the trial counsel was giving their closing, and they said, well, look, we didn't object because we know that this particular counsel puts on a performance and the members have seen him before and they pay no attention to him. And so it wasn't in our interest to keep jumping up and objecting to make us look bad, and that's why we let him carry on. Now, is that a reasonable trial strategy?
We don't know what they would say.
No, we don't know. But that's my hypothetical. What if that's what happened?
But we also then would have to know what the judge would have done. What if the judge also then made an error and either sustained or overruled the objection that was...
No, I'm saying the defense counsel is telling you that he did not object for a particular strategic purpose. In other words, we wanted the members to see this overacting, overzealous prosecutor at work. We know that they don't pay him any attention because we've had him before and the members have seen him before.
Yes, that decision by the trial defense, though, Your Honor, would not change the fact that the prosecutor stepped over the bounds and that the judge also had an obligation to make sure that this type of argument did not go on. And so regardless of whether they had a decision to object or not to object, at the end of the day, there was a line. The prosecutor waltzed right past it repeatedly and kept going back, and no one checked his behavior. No one. And we're here today trying to understand if Airman Matty
got a fair trial. So your position is that it can only be that your client was convicted because of this argument. Is that what you're saying?
There is a reasonable probability that Airman Matty was convicted on something other than the evidence because of the type of arguments that were made, the pervasiveness of the arguments, the way that they flowed together and built upon one another. So not only do we have, again, the defense has an obligation, they're also presenting this bad conspiracy theory, lying type of information to the panel.
And in my hypothetical, what you seem to be suggesting is that had you made that call to the defense, and that's what they told you, that would not be a proper strategic choice on their part.
We would be more like Voorhees, where there was some indication that they let this go for that very reason, yet this court still found plain error in Voorhees.
Well, not for some reason. What if they just flat out and say it? We didn't object because that was our strategy. We strategically and intentionally did not object.
Yes, and we would still have a plain error. We would still have it. Regardless of their decisions, the conduct occurred. The panel was tainted with this argument, and it went unchecked, and now we're here wondering whether Airman Matty got a fair trial. And the answer is he didn't.
All right, well, let me throw another brick at you.
Counsel, could
go ahead, Judge.
Could the errors have been corrected through instructions?
Possibly.
How would the corrected instructions be different from the instructions that were actually given?
It could have been a number of things. They could have told counsel to stop making these type of arguments. They could have had also a special instruction saying, as a reminder, these types of arguments you need to disregard. You need to decide only on the evidence, that kind of thing. But
I ask this because, as you started with the litany of cases that we get. Mm-hmm. Trial counsel keeps making these arguments. Defense counsel keeps not objecting, and the military judges keep not stepping in. And the question is the solution to this to have some standard instructions that would cover these kinds of things?
If the trial judiciary wants to come up with some standard instructions to make sure that these types of things are covered, possibly, but the answer, we still have to address what happened in this particular case.
I understand that, but we'll address it in this case, and then we'll address it in the next case, and the next case. It would be better if we didn't have these future cases. I mean, one of the problems is it's pretty easy to see what an error is. You can't say this witness is a liar, but it's hard to determine whether there is or is not prejudice. I mean, that's what we're confronted with in these cases, and we've seen that no matter how many opinions we issue, the arguments still are being made, and there's still no objections. And I'm just trying to think, where do we get past this, or is this just part of the staple of our cases from now on?
Your Honor, we have clear examples from this court about what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. And yes, we keep having these same arguments. That doesn't mean we shouldn't keep taking them up. Because any of these arguments tainting any conviction are problematic for our justice system. We need to be seeking justice, not to be seeking a conviction. And so when we're evaluating, you asked a question, Your Honor, about prejudice. It's hard to determine in this particular case, or in any of these cases, what the outcome really would have been absent these objections. So briefly, as I've discussed, this is instead of the members going back and being able to evaluate credibility based on the actual evidence, they have testimony that she is credible. From the prosecutor. They have statements that she should be believed because she is a victim. They have statements about the process on her and how hard it was, so we should believe her for that reason as well. But then they also have lingering questions put into their mind about what the defense failed to do in a scenario in which they had no obligation to prove defense. to prove anything. They don't have to prove alternate sources of injury. And not only that, they have this idea that all of this evidence, in order for them to vote for an acquittal, that the defense would have had to have established that Ehrman, that all of the witnesses were lying.
But wasn't all of that contradicted by the standard instructions given by the military judge?
It wasn't enough in this particular case, because when this court evaluated, for example, in Fletcher, they looked at the fact that there was some objection, that there was a quick instruction that was given, a brief one, and then the standard instructions were still not enough in that case. In evaluating prejudice in Fletcher, the court looked at the volume. How many times? 21 pages of arguments, several dozen instances of improper argument, or lines of improper argument. Here we have approximately 23 pages of findings argument, and we have more than 18 instances, which are laid out in our reply brief at page 16 through 18, and it goes through sequentially, and it lists out all of the different lines of argument, and you can see how they build upon one another. So we are very similar in terms of the severity of the conduct as we are in Fletcher, and we also know that the standard instructions there were not enough. And they also had some objection and an additional instruction given, and yet it still wasn't enough. In evaluating the weight of the evidence for Fletcher, they looked at the fact that his whole defense was essentially that he was a religious upstanding person and that he wouldn't be the type of person to do drugs, and the government's case was a naked urinalysis. And the court said, look, that is not, it's strong, it can, you can have a conviction based on your analysis, but that is not enough. And here we have something less than that. We have a witness with credibility problems, and we have all of these witnesses who don't truly corroborate her version of these injuries. And so we don't have a very strong case to show that this did not have an impact. And it's also the types of arguments that were made that shows that they were focused solely on this evidence related to specifications 2 and 3, and those are the only ones he was convicted of. When the prosecutor chose to weave the burden-shifting arguments, the improper bolstering, and the vouching for inserted facts, not in evidence, he abandoned his duty to seek justice. And justice demands relief. Thank you.
Before you leave, any further questions? Thank you, Major Herman. Major Barris.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Vanessa Barrows, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Trial counsel's unobjected to arguments were not error for two reasons. First, the argument was tethered to the evidence, and second, the argument was a proper response to the defense's theory of the case, beginning in opening statements that all the government witnesses lied.
So, counsel. In Fletcher, this court held that a trial counsel commits professional misconduct when his or her arguments, quote, could be perceived as putting the weight of the government behind the testimony of the witness. Here we have a situation where trial counsel not only says she's credible, which could be interpreted as making the argument, members of the panel, when you look at the totality of the evidence that has been presented to you, we think you will conclude that she was credible. But here, trial counsel also says she's telling the truth. There, why shouldn't this court look at that as essentially being an argument being made to the panel members that we, the omniscient government, know what really happened here? We know, members of the panel, how these wily defense counsel are able to keep relevant information away from panels. We're telling you she's telling the truth. Why shouldn't that be perceived as being completely poisonous to the deliberations of the panel here?
Because when trial counsel mentioned that she's telling the truth, that was mentioned when arguing the credibility of witnesses, and when trial counsel began that argument, he referenced the military judge's instructions, and he stated, and I quote, members, you have the absolute responsibility to determine the credibility of the witnesses, and the military judge instructed you on this. And then following that, Trial counsel is then giving reasons why he did not have a reason to lie, which is proper argument. And
so you're arguing separate from the question I have. When the person who's representing the government says she's telling the truth, why shouldn't we expect the panel to believe that the omniscient government knows more than what has been presented to the panel? And we are telling you, based on that understanding that we have, she is telling you the truth, therefore you must believe her. Why isn't that a toxic approach that infects the deliberations of the panel?
It's not a toxic approach, Your Honor, because trial counsel should be.
You say it's not toxic. How does that fit with Fletcher? Exactly what this court says is verboten.
Because, Your Honor, you have to take a look at the context in which trial counsel is making these arguments. You cannot surgically carve out a statement. So you can't just look independently that she's telling the truth. When you're looking at the statement of she's telling the truth, you have to look at the context in which trial counsel is arguing. And he's arguing that he had no reason to lie. And if you look at
He didn't say that, counsel. He didn't say she has no reason to lie. He said she's telling the truth.
Correct, but
you don't see the distinction between those?
I do see the distinction, Your Honor, but again, looking at context, when he's making the statement that she's telling the truth, he is then arguing the evidence elicited throughout trial that had no reason to lie. She had no reason to fabricate.
So you want this court to say, in its opinion in this case, that it's perfectly fine for trial counsel to say to a panel, this witness who is testifying on behalf of the government is telling you the truth. You want us to say that, in our opinion, that that's perfectly fine.
I think a message that this court could send to the field regarding credibility of witnesses is that trial counsel can comment on the credibility so long as they're basing their argument in the evidence presented at trial and not attempting to put their prestige behind the witnesses with their personal assurances. So what trial counsel here?
What you've just quoted goes to the very point I've been trying to hammer home here, putting the prestige of the government behind the testimony.
But when trial counsel is saying that she's telling the truth, that's not putting the prestige of the government behind the witness, because that statement is, again, rooted in evidence because stated that, in other words, she didn't have a reason to make up the allegations. The allegations was never part of
right.
the divorce proceedings.
Okay, we've pursued that enough. Let me go to the point that Judge Maggs, I think, has touched upon. This court has had many cases where we keep on saying, this is professional misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct. Counsel, you cannot be making these types of comments. Then we're having counsel who get up there and make a display of how learned they are, how experienced they are, how they've traveled across the globe to prosecute these cases. They're specially trained, and they're making these arguments that this court keeps on saying you can't make. What is this court supposed to do to hammer this point home? And not to put trial counsel completely in the seat of blame, we've then got defense counsel, as Judge Sparks is talking about, sits there and doesn't object. And, of course, we have military judges who don't insert themselves. I think in large measure it comes down to the issue of prejudice. But what are we to do as a court to make it clear what arguments cannot be made because they are improper?
I think this court made it clear in Voorhees what is improper, and this case doesn't even come nowhere close in Voorhees. In that case, trial defense counsel is disparaging. Defense counsel disparaging appellant, calling the appellant in that case a farm animal, a pig, but we don't have that here.
So are you saying, if it's not a Voorhees case, no problem?
No, Your Honor, but when looking at this specific case, the conduct by trial counsel here does not cross the line into Voorhees.
I understand your point about this specific case, but what is it that you would have this court write in its opinion in terms of what argument is permissible here when we've got situations where trial counsel is saying she's telling the truth, talking about the misstatements that have been made by the defense counsel, not getting into it, and a number of other concerns that have been raised by the defense here. How are you saying we should approach this?
I think, you know, as I stated, that's, you can argue about the credibility of witnesses, especially when credibility is of such central importance to a case, as it was in this case. Both sides were arguing about the credibility of witnesses. But I think this case is a good example for the field to show that what is proper argument. Trial counsel never once used personal pronouns nor offered personal views of the evidence. He never said, trust me, I'm the senior prosecutor in this case. I've interviewed the victim. I know she's credible. Trust my word. Instead, trial counsel emphasized the military judge's instruction on credibility and told the members that it was their responsibility to determine credibility of witnesses. And then trial counsel's then arguing facts and evidence that did not have any
counsel,
financial...
So, counsel, you're getting down into the nitty-gritty. I'm asking you for the 64,000-foot level. So you're saying this court should say, as long as you don't use personal pronouns, good to go. Make any type of attacks, make any types of representations, just don't use personal pronouns.
I think it's going to be difficult for this court to cite a bright-line rule because I think it's going to be case-by-case basis in what's going to toe the line of improper argument. But so long as if you're arguing about the credibility of witnesses and conclusions are based on the evidence elicited throughout trial, then that is proper argument. And other circuit courts...
You keep saying that, and I keep mentioning to you there's a difference. I carved out right at the beginning of my questioning of you this issue we're talking about credibility. And I keep trying to point you to the statement of she's telling the truth. You don't see any distinction between saying to panel members, look at all the evidence here. You can see that based on this evidence that you can rely on her testimony from saying blanket from a trial counsel, she's telling the truth. You don't see any distinction there.
I think if you look into the context in which trial counsel is making these statements, it's also he's signposting for the members of where this argument is going. So when he's saying that you have a credible witness, it's just saying, hey, members, I'm going to then talk to you later on in my argument about the credibility of witnesses. And so I understand your concerns, Your Honor, where you might, if you surgically carve out a statement that says that she's telling the truth, but again, you have to look at the context. And the Supreme Court has said that the context is imperative when looking at improper arguments. And if looking at the entirety of trial counsel's statements, there's no improper vouching. This is not a case in Voorhees.
What would be improper vouching? Right? I think what the Chief is trying to explain is that it's perfectly fine to say, let me explain to you all the reasons why you should believe her, which I think he's saying that's very different than saying she's telling the truth. Right? One is vouching, one is not. But you said that's not vouching. So what would be vouching? In the government's view, what would be improper vouching?
I think Voorhees is an example of improper vouching where trial counsel is setting up through voir dire that I travel the world 250 days of the year to try the most serious cases and then using that same premise in his closing argument to say, I don't travel 250 days to sell you a story. I mean, that is trial counsel saying, believe me, I try the most serious cases, and therefore I know that this victim is telling the truth. You don't have any of that conduct here in this case. And so
unless you happen to be someone who travels over the world, then everyone else is, all other trial counsel are free to vouch for witnesses. It's just the ones who have special experience who can't. It seems like an odd rule.
No, I'm just answering Your Honor's question, saying that that's just merely an example of improper vouching. But again, if you can argue that a witness is credible, so long as that is tethered to the evidence.
I don't want to retread ground, but I think the point is you can explain to the panel why they should believe someone, which is different than sort of commanding them to believe someone.
But I don't think in context here that trial counsel is commanding that they should find credible, especially in light of the military judge's instruction that trial counsel highlighted.
Let's talk about another aspect of it. How about this, the conspiracy? Why does trial counsel talk about conspiracies? The defense never mentioned a conspiracy. That's a very loaded term. Where does that come from? What is the justification for describing the defense theory as a grand conspiracy?
So conspiracy theory was rhetorical flourish that trial counsel used to describe the defense's far-fetched theory of the case. And that beginning in opening statements, they're saying that all the witnesses lied in the defense opening.
Where is the word lie in the defense's opening? Because I looked for it and I didn't find it.
I think lie can be inferred, but if you're looking at
the defense. Okay, so they never accused, they never accused all the witnesses of lying. What they said was all the reason, the witnesses you're going to hear from, they all have potential biases, right?
Correct. And essentially what's a reasonable inference made from the cross-examinations of the government witnesses is that they lied. And if you look at the cross-examination of the roommate, they're suggesting that it was upset at appellant because appellant was paying too much rent, so had a motive.
But there's a lot of inferences being drawn here, right? You're inferring that they're alleging there's a grand conspiracy, but they never said there was a grand conspiracy. You're inferring that they're calling them all liars, but they never actually called them all liars. Right, to the extent that anybody was calling them liars or truth tellers, it was the government who was coming out and telling them they're truth tellers. And that the defense is lying. Right? Like, I didn't find anything in the defense's opening statement, or in their closing for that matter, where they are drawing the kind of conclusions, not citing the evidence, but drawing the kind of conclusions that the trial counsel was drawing.
But that's the underpinning of what trial defense counsel was getting out during the cross-examinations. And using the conspiracy theory, again, was not inflammatory language.
It's not inflammatory?
No, Your Honor, because it's just how trial
counsel. You wouldn't
counsel
consider having your argument at trial called a grand conspiracy inflammatory to the panel?
The trial defense counsel never called appellant or trial defense counsel a conspiracy theorist. He's just saying that the case that they put on, that they would have you believe that there's this whole big conspiracy theory. But that is just how trial counsel described how far-fetched the defense's theory was, and that all the government.
They were describing that it was fantastical.
No, Your Honor, I just think that
right, right? That's what you're saying. They were describing how fantastical it was, which is exactly what this court has already held you're not supposed to do.
But it wouldn't be plain and obvious error, and if it was so obvious, then you would at least expect an objection, and an objection would have helped clarify and resolve these issues at the time at trial.
Well, I think as Judge Sparks already pointed out, an objection would have been really helpful. But we're not getting objections, and so, and maybe this is an answer for the government, but like we can't figure out, we keep telling the field and the fleet, you don't do this, you can't do this. But then at the same time, we often find no prejudice. So I'm not sure what message exactly it is we're sending to the field and fleet. Are we sending them the message that you can't do this, but it's okay if you do, don't worry about it, it's probably okay. Maybe in this case, we should send a harsher message.
You know, that could be a possibility, but just because there's a lack of objection doesn't mean that there wasn't some strategic case for defense for not objecting. Maybe they thought that trial counsel was actually, in fact, making the argument that they were saying that, yeah, all the government witnesses did lie. I mean, that I would be speculating at this point, but that could be a reason why they didn't object. But just even going back to the term conspiracy theory, appellant has not met its burden to prove that it was plain and obvious error. There have been other jurisdictions who found that the term conspiracy theory used in closing arguments to describe how defense's theory could be so far-fetched is not improper.
Was there any suggestion in defense counsel's closing that they were alleging there was some vast conspiracy theory, that somehow all these people had gotten together to concoct this giant lie that was being presented to the panel? Or did they just basically attack the sufficiency of the evidence?
They attacked the sufficiency of the evidence, but in order to make sense of defense's theory of the case, it was not improper for then trial counsel to then characterize it of how far-fetched it would have been. I mean, trial defense counsel was attacking credibility from the onset of her cross-examination and continued that during closing arguments, for example, of trying to undermine how she got an injury to her chin, to which trial counsel then made a rebuttal argument in his rebuttal in closing. But all of this is all of trial counsel's arguments, again, was tethered to the evidence and tethered to the defense's theory of the case. And the purpose of closing arguments is to comment on the weaknesses of a defense's case, and it's not a personal attack on defense counsel. And looking at closing arguments, the purpose is to allow counsel to offer ways of viewing the significance of the evidence. And that's
so what about with the burden shifting, where trial counsel said, quote, and I want to make it clear, I'm putting in a couple words here to make it clear, what you have not been given is any reasonable alternative explanation for where the bruises on the victim's chin came from. Why is that not a problem?
It's not a problem because I think you also have to look at the context in which that statement was said, and that was in rebuttal argument. And so in trial defense counsel's argument, he is undermining how he could have gotten that injury to her chin when appellant at that charge, he was charged with pressing his knee against her back. And so he's saying with that, you would expect an injury to her back but not an injury to her chin. So when trial counsel in rebuttal argument is then explaining how she could have gotten an injury to the chin or even attacking defense's explanation of how she got the injury to the chin, that essentially was provoked by defense, and it was still proper argument. And so there was no point at which trial counsel, shifted the burden of proof. The trial counsel never said defense needed to get up here and present you with evidence. They needed to call their client to the stand. But statements made by a prosecutor on the failure by defense, as opposed to the defendant, to counter or explain evidence does not violate a defendant's Fifth Amendment right not to testify. So when trial counsel...
Counsel also said the defense hasn't given you any explanation. How does that fit with what you're just saying?
Because even as appellant stated, the defense didn't have to put a case at all, but they chose to affirmatively put on a case, as seen throughout the cross-examination, that undermined the credibility of government witnesses. In trial counsel can attack the case that the defense put on, because they chose to put on that case. So it would be unfair for trial counsel to not be able to respond to the defense theory of the case, especially when purpose of closing argument is to attack the other theories of the case presented by opposing counsel, and that goes for both sides.
So counsel, in your response to the chief, you brought up, we've been talking about the statement that was made during rebuttal, and you said that was directly addressing what the defense had said in their closing. But what about all those, and this is still in shifting the burden, all of those findings arguments wherein trial counsel says, defense's failure to provide the panel with any reasonable explanation as to why any of this occurred. It's a lie. The defense needs to get up here and say that all these people are just lying to you. It's all one giant conspiracy. Who else were you presented with? How is that not implicating the accused Fifth Amendment rights?
It's not implicating, because when you're reading these statements in context, it's trial counsel refuting what trial defense counsel is already putting before the members. And, Your Honor, if I may
please respond to Judge Johnson.
And even if you're looking at the comment of defense, who have you been presented with, that's a prime example of why you should not surgically carve out statements without regard for its context. When trial counsel is saying who else have you been presented with, that's when he's discussing the corroborating evidence. And then he even then mentions that who else you've been presented with was text messages between an appellant's parents. And that goes to show that he then told the abuse to appellant's parents. So who else you've been presented with was not a knock on that appellant failed to call any witnesses. And so that's just an example of how there was not burden shifting in this case.
Any further questions? You may briefly conclude.
Your Honor, for reasons discussed, trial counsel's arguments were not error, and even so, they were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt or harmless. There was no prejudice in this case.
Thank you, Major Barris. Major Herbers.
The question was posed, what do we do with these types of cases that keep coming back? How do we send the message? You send a message, but in this case, by finding prejudice and granting relief, because that actually holds the government accountable in this case. It's necessary and based
in the evidence and in the current law. When you look at Fletcher and why this court granted relief in Fletcher, we have that same type of conduct. We had four different types of argument in Fletcher that were ultimately problematic, but they didn't have a burden-shifting argument. We have four separate types, and one of them is a burden-shifting argument. Not only that, we have similarly not strong evidence. We have weak evidence in this case to go to the weight of the evidence.
Can I ask you, though, is it really appropriate for an appellate court to send a message in terms of saying, you know what, in this case, we're going to find prejudice, even if, based on our precedent where we need to engage in a weighing of different things, if this were a typical case, we wouldn't find prejudice, but we want to send a message. Is that really a proper role for an appellate court to take?
Your Honor, if that's what I implied, that's not what I meant. In this case, it's necessary because it's required based off the evidence that we have. And so the message would be clear with this case as an example because it is ripe for relief. There is evidence of burden shifting. There is evidence of disparaging defense, vouching for and also inserting facts not in the record.
So you're not saying that we should come to a decision, for instance, if the court, and I'm not suggesting one way or the other, but if the court would say, all right, we're really fed up with this. We need to send this message. We're going to reverse the case and send it back for whatever reasons. That would be in violation of Article 59A, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we are asking the court to grant relief because it's justified in this case, not simply to send a message. But it would send a message because this is a vehicle for that message.
All right, well, so you're saying that there's been material prejudice to the accused's substantial right to, can you fill in the blank?
Be tried based on the evidence alone, be convicted based on the evidence alone, not have to prove his innocence, to be able to know that the members convicted him based solely on their interpretation of the credibility of the witnesses and not the prosecutors. We want Ehrman Mahdi to be convicted because the evidence said so, not because the prosecutor said so. And we are only here because the prosecutor manipulated the evidence with his argument. He changed the landscape of the evidence for the members, redirected their focus from their own responsibility and obligation to assess the credibility, and made them focus solely on the prosecutor, what he thought the evidence showed, and also what the defense failed to do. This case is ripe for relief, and we ask this court to grant relief.
Any further questions? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.